You got to hear what happens. So we send out a weekly newsletter about like events and news going on. It's called Tampa. Well, the podcast version is called Tampa Talk. The newsletter is called Word on the Streets, right? So you can subscribe, Word on the Streets, XYZ. It's just kind of like, here's what went on last week. Like, it'll come out tomorrow morning. Here's some events coming up, like Gasparilla this weekend. Here's like this week in Tampa history stuff. And so he's helping like editorially, like, hey, I found some interesting news, some events or whatever. He sent me a link to the meetup for this. And I was like, oh my God, I feel like an idiot. I should have announced that on Tampa Talk like last week. And he's like, oh, no big deal. You didn't know. And I was like, no, you don't understand. We've been planning this for a while. This is like our event. And I just didn't think of it. But he found it as he was doing the research for putting that out. So it didn't make it because it comes out tomorrow. So we didn't put it in for this week. But by the way, I'm John Dengler. I am the CEO of a little nonprofit holding company called Well Built Cities. We run like a social venture studio. So we build kind of social enterprise and social infrastructure. So things like you might have heard of Well Built Bikes, a nonprofit bike shop, sell refurbished bikes, and Well Fed Community, which does a lot in the food system space and education, handful of other things, working a lot with materially poor neighbors. I'm not going to dig into a lot of this tonight, but it is what initially caught my interest in this, because I'm about building new economies, creating access, and I saw a lot of promise in these tools beyond, let's say, like monetary value. I saw tools for community development. Like, I'm like, this is something the Black Panther Party wishes they had. You know what I mean? Like, this is revolutionary technology that can really make an impact and something that really excited me. You can go ahead to the next one there. I'll just go ahead and jump in. So we'll start with this. Think about this. Has your life become more digital or less? It's pretty simple answer. I just think to yourself, like, when was the last time you wrote a physical letter? Like by hand. How much of your communication has become digital? Like email, text, Zoom? Or what about your like tools, your organizational tools, your calendar, your notes, et cetera, et cetera? What about entertainment? Like YouTube, Hulu, Netflix? And then what about payments? What about money? Credit cards, Venmo, Cash App, online payments. So I don't know if you know this, but the reality is that only 8% of all money on earth exists physically. That means the other 92% is non-physical, digital. When you receive a paycheck or you pay your Netflix subscription or you order that cool thing on Amazon, those transactions are happening digitally without any physical cash changing hands. And most modern financial activity, including banks, have gone digital. It's second nature to think about assets existing electronically. So I want to stick with money to think about this, as I think it will help set us up well to discuss some key concepts tonight. Go to the next one. So if you took physical cash, like I have a dollar and I give you the dollar, so person A gives it to person B, this is how we've done money for a long, long time. And it's like, well, now you know that I don't have it and you have it. It's very clean and very clear. We go to the next one. So what if we naively go, well, let's try to figure out a digital version of that. How can we do it digitally? Well, like the dollar has a serial number on it. So maybe I could just email you the serial number. But like that doesn't quite work, does it? Why? Because I still have the serial number. I could also send it to grandma and I could send it to Leo and I could send it to multiple other people. This is what they call the double spend problem. And it was actually really difficult to ensure that digital money is not easily duplicatable. And so what we would do then is, you can go to the next one, trusted third parties such as banks would be called in to prevent double spend. So they would introduce a centralized third party that would debit A and credit B. And this is how we generally solve this problem. Banks and other major institutions have become the central authority to keep the centralized ledger. And now this may work in general, but I would argue that this system has some major vulnerabilities baked into it. Let's set that aside for now. And I want to look a little bit into the evolution of the internet so that we can maybe get our head around the term Web3, since this is what we promised to get into here tonight. So the internet has evolved. Maybe most of us are old enough to kind of have seen that play out. How many of you remember, go ahead to the next one. How many of you remember the first time you connected to the internet and you heard that dial-up, whatever sound, and you made that like connect, you know, it connected you to the like World Wide Web, the information superhighway, and you typed in HTTP, /, whatever, and we would then find web pages, static web pages, news articles that were posted online. It's kind of like an online reading experience. Now, there were chat rooms in the early days, but the majority of the early internet, which you would now refer to maybe as Web 1, of course, then you wouldn't have, because like this is just the World Wide Web. It's the most amazing thing ever. But it was a read-only experience for the most part. Go to the next one. Websites that did allow users to log in would require a username and a password, which they did not store, and which a user would have to type in every time. My mom still has this like notebook, this paper notebook that says, "What the fuck is my password?" on the front. And it's like this ledger for all of her passwords. It's a cool notebook. But then in 2004, we began to see the emergence of what would be called Web 2.0. Web 2.0 was a read-write experience where Web 1 was a read-only. And so you'd see the emergence of MySpace. You guys remember this guy? Friendster, Blogger, Facebook, YouTube, Flickr, that made it more possible for web users to interact and collaborate with one another in ways that had never before existed. The earlier generation of the web limited us to be, let's say, passive content consumers, to go and read the news there or whatever. But with the rise of social media, it turned users into creators that would generate really the majority of the content that we found on the platforms themselves. And then we had things like tagging and likes and hashtags and podcasts and streaming. And on this goes. And the volume of content exploded exponentially and increased as every web user is effectively a content creator. You can go ahead to the next one. Web 2 also allowed us to use one of our main accounts with one of the big companies, Facebook or Google, to remain logged in and then use that to connect. It's handy, right? Like, oh, just like connect with Google. By simply clicking one of these big tech services that would serve as our login and our identity in these other places. Now, before I continue to describe the evolution of the internet, I want to point something out. The early internet was a very decentralized space. Nobody owned it, nobody controlled it, and many, if not all of the folks that ran even like little websites would effectively have to like run their own server or hire a webmaster who would do that for them. With Web 2, all of the amazing apps and the things that evolved gave us a far more rich experience of the internet. And we saw this major shift, though, towards centralization. Most of what you experience online today lives in server farms that are owned by like one of a couple companies, Amazon, Google. And life has become more and more centralized. And I want to return for a minute to the way that we chose to solve the double spend problem, that challenge with digital currency. So go ahead to the next one. So what we would do then is in this, we introduced this central third party to debit A and credit B, but from like a computer science typology, and tell me if I'm right here, but it is very inelegant to have such a privileged node if you can avoid it. Yes. It's like, wow, what a vulnerability. All the permissions and all the power exist in a certain node. Well, in the year 2008, a group of anonymous technologists, philosophers, visionaries, started a revolution. And amidst the global financial crisis, they set out to build a new digital economy, an economic system for their own that utilized peer-to-peer networks so that no single person or entity controlled it and anyone could use it. So when Satoshi Nakamoto came up with this distributed ledger with a peer-to-peer network called a blockchain. Blockchain network prevents double spend by allowing every member to verify transactions to verify every transaction. You go to the next. I think I haven't threw an extra slide in here. Yeah, just if any one miner decided not to mine a transaction, the others will because they're rewarded for mining the transaction. So it introduced a bunch of competing nodes all trying to mine that transaction. And it created a digital analog to what physical cash was that solved the centralized privileged node problem. Little did they know, that this novel payment project would be worth trillions of dollars in just like a decade. It would rival gold as an asset. It would explode into many different use cases that today we have come to call Web3. You can go ahead to the next one. We're seeing the rise of what is being called Web3. And as far as we can tell, it is impossible to overstate the importance of the shift we are seeing today. If Web1 was read, Web2 was read-write, then Web3 is read-write-own. And the ability to own digital assets, to control identity, without reliance on any of these big tech services, is made it possible by the emergence of peer-to-peer networks, keeping immutable public ledgers on a technology called blockchains. And like Leo referenced earlier, almost everyone who has started to learn about Web3, and tell me, like, give me some amens if this is true, has referred to the experience as falling down the rabbit hole. So even The Economist used this allusion to Alice in Wonderland in their cover story on decentralized finance and Web3. So Web3 is an umbrella term for a vision of a better internet, an internet with an added identity, money, and social layers. So you could think of Bitcoin as a tamper-resistant database for storing value. And then a new blockchain launched in 2014 that was far more programmable than Bitcoin. It was called Ethereum. You go to the next one. I wonder if I have, like, let me see what's next. Yeah, okay. So in Web2, if you want to move to a new platform, you can't actually bring your history with you in any way that retains its legitimacy. You have to basically start over. By the way, I had like a YouTube account back in the day. I used to make these videos. I thought were good. Like, I was proud of them. I would sit and it was like philosophy and whatever, and I would like rant at these videos. And I do not have access to these anymore because that apparently was, I was using some paid like corporate account of YouTube. Like, I had like, it was like at a domain that ceased to be paid and then it just vanished. And I learned a big lesson in like the vulnerability of like allowing my stuff to be stored on like their servers. But you have to start over. Whereas with Web3, you can choose to take your data, your money, to another platform whenever you want, because you are not anchored. The database and the platform become the equivalent of a global utility, accessible and open to anyone for really for any purpose. And in this new web, regular websites or applications are referred to as decentralized apps, or some say dApps or dApps, however you want to pronounce it. I tend to go with dApps. Typically with you'll see like a Connect wallet. This is kind of the way that you will kind of sign in. These are usually open and free for all to use, regardless of where you are located or what industry you come from. Go ahead to the next one. So then the question becomes, like, what do you care about? Maybe you're an artist, and creators can interact directly with their fans using these tools. They can bake in fair compensation to their work without forking over a huge percentage of their money to, let's say, these big tech platforms that allowed them to sell through before, or maybe finance that gives millions of unbanked people easy, free financial access, or identity. You control your identity online and reveal the parts of your identity that you decide to reveal as you decide to. Ownership. Web3 technology enables provably scarce digital items, whether they be digital trading cards or tickets to an event or in-game items, digital music or art, Community, online social clubs provide perks to members, online residency programs, and are even used to collectively bid on rare items. My favorite version of that is, I don't know if you guys know that Wu-Tang recorded a one-of-one album called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. There was only one made. It's a double disc set. They auctioned it off, and what's that dude's, Martin Shkreli won it, the like super villain himself. But when he went to prison and they took all of his stuff, they auctioned it all off. And then Pleaser DAO, this group of kind of Web3 kind of pooled resources that are getting like culturally significant things, and they won. Anyway, so communities can buy rare items that they have. Now they're not allowed to play it publicly, so they can only do listening parties. So you have to like show up somewhere where they're doing it. And until, I think we're 80 years out from it can be publicly released. So like in 80 years, I hope I'm still around. I'm trying to hear that album. And then one that I didn't have on the slide here, but also is really important and significant to me, is credentials. So maybe it's your little badge from your training that you have, like currently maybe on your LinkedIn or something. But badges from trainings, or a kind of proof of work that functions as a CV or a resume. Like, I've coded this, I've programmed this, I've done this, I've accomplished this. And actually having verified accomplishments and credentials that you could have represented in a wallet. But the big takeaway here is Web3 is a movement that grants me and you ownership over your data, identity, and assets. So let's talk about identity for a second, because I'm not sure it's immediately obvious to everyone how important that actually is. Go ahead to the next one. So what is identity? I mean, the simplest definition would be like proof of who you are. So we use systems to verify and authenticate you. So your name, your age, your home address, your email address, medical records, the login credentials you use for your electric company, so you can pay your bills and deal with them and all of the other many, many websites and portals you have to go through. But these all contribute to defining your identity. While the current methods we use to obtain, store, and share these pieces of ourselves, they work, but they're all separate and compose challenges. So maybe you've had, have you ever lost like an ID and then tried to get an ID? You know, you need ID to get ID, which is crazy. So like, I work with a lot of folks on the streets and they like lost their backpack. They had their birth certificate and their ID, and it's like, they're doomed. You can't do it. It can't be done. It can be done, but it's like, you need like a high level college degree to kind of get through the process. But it's like, you need that. Or try to gather your medical history. It can prove very difficult, especially if you've relocated or gone to different doctors, and try to like gather all those things together. Or try to keep track, like my mom's notebook, of your usernames and logins for email, bank, school. It can be a real headache. Every aspect of your life involves identity and identification of some kind, from housing to employment to education to medical history. And the more you do, the larger this kind of web of identity becomes. And what would it be like if all of these pieces of information were owned and controlled by you, and they were held together in one place, and they were accessible to you? Like, you know, I go to the doctor and they're like, have you had any surgeries? I'm like, lots. What are they? Like, I don't know. Some stuff. Never mind. I haven't had any. This technology exists today, and it is evolving every day. And in Web3, new ways about thinking about identity are being imagined to address the next phase of digital identity. You can go to the next one. To navigate Web3, you need a crypto wallet. Similar to how browsers serve as a gateway to the internet, wallets serve as a gateway to interacting with crypto apps known as dApps, illustrating the role of traditional and digital wallets as you know them. So like, I have a wallet. You have like, start with like a physical wallet, and this will hold things. Maybe you keep it in your purse or in your pocket, but it has like, you know, your ID. Maybe you have a little bit of cash. I don't have a lot. Maybe you have some credit cards, right? Maybe you have a picture of a loved one. So they carry some stuff. And then you have like, I don't know what my phone is, but on your phone, you have like a digital wallet, right? A lot of us will have a digital wallet, and it's very similar. It'll hold a variety of digital objects, credit card information, digital cash, maybe a photo of your driver's license, concert tickets, boarding passes, and there's a few other things that they're used for. And crypto wallets are a form of digital wallet designed for Web3 to store cryptocurrency, NFTs, and more. And they help you manage permissions with whom and when and where you share your data. So all wallets at their core, physical or digital, hold your like authority to so you can exercise it wherever you go. And so I like to think about a crypto wallet as kind of a passport for Web3. And the wallet is a means for storing and managing your identity, represented by digital keys. And you need these keys to do anything on the blockchain then, to connect to a dApp, to receive or to send crypto, to sell or buy digital assets or NFTs. So think of your wallet as like a Web3 permissions manager, where you can grant access to the apps that you want to use. And the moment your crypto wallet is created, there's a unique phrase is generated known as your, and you can go to the next one, I think it has some like illustration of this, your secret recovery phrase or your seed phrase. And this is the seed from which your digital public address and private keys kind of sprout from. By the way, this is not a, it says Bollywood, this is not, don't, this is not a real seed phrase, right? Yeah. The public, so you get like a public address. This is what like a public address will look like down here. And then you'll get this like seed phrase or this secret recovery phrase. I like that they're trying to use the language of like secret, because if anyone has this, it's kind of keys to the kingdom, so to speak. Now, I want to like pause for a second on this and talk a little bit about, so you've got a couple kinds of wallets, right? So you'll have like what's called a custodial and a non-custodial wallet. So custodial, let's say, means, I would say more or less means centralized. So like a Coinbase, like maybe you have an account with Coinbase and you go through like the KYC. It's like setting up a bank account, right? And you can buy, I actually think it's a great way to buy currencies. Like I want to put some cash from my bank and I'm going to buy some ETH or some BTC. And then, but I would say to use those, like what I would do is use those like a public restroom, like do your business and then get out. Like take those assets and move them to a non-custodial wallet, which means one that you hold. So you'll hear this phrase in crypto sometimes, like, what is it? Not your keys, not your coin. There you go. I was gonna say seed. I was like, that's not right. Not your keys, not your coin. And then in that realm, you have a couple different kinds of wallets. So you'll have what's called a hot and a cold. And so a hot wallet is like something like a MetaMask. There's a bunch of them. I've just been favorable to MetaMask because I use it a couple. But this is like an in-browser kind of software app. It's great. But if you start like really accruing value or holding things that are significantly important, there is what's called a hardware wallet. It looks a lot like a Ledger or Trezor. Is that what they're called? So you can buy these. I would encourage you to buy them directly from the companies, not like from Amazon or something like that, where someone could have like already like rewrapped it or something like that. So what this functions as is like this, the seed phrase, the keys exist within this then. So you would have to plug it into your computer and to sign or transact in any way. It's great. It's much more secure. It's slower, tedious, like it's frustrating sometimes. So I kind of go vault, day to day, right? So I have both, like I have things down here, and then I'll just have like my kind of a hot wallet. It's more like not as valuable stuff in it, but like it's like walking around, you know what I mean? Like you can do something with it in a quicker way. But I want to take a minute to be very clear about your recovery phrase, because I do not think this can be overstated. So your crypto wallet allows you to store the information that identifies you in one place, things you own. When you create the wallet, you'll be given 12 words, like we showed you up here. These 12 words are the seed of your digital identity and used to generate the keys that you create and grant access to your wallet.
If anyone has that phrase, they are able to access your wallet and everything in it. So to protect your identity and digital assets, you must protect this. You can think like you wouldn't share your PIN number to your bank account.
But the safest way to protect your identity or your recovery phrase is to write these words down manually on paper. Some of us will actually like engrave it in metal or something like that so that water can't damage the paper, fire can't, you know, it's like this is super significant. Now, when you first set it up, you're like, come on, what are we talking about? This is crazy. Until you like, you know, homie bought a bunch of Bitcoin for under a dollar, you know, it's like, those are valuable. And I assure you, those are that seed phrase is stored somewhere that nobody knows. And there's like half of it written here and the other half's in Ecuador. And like, because God forbid someone gains access to that, right? So it's very, very important. And then you never, ever want to store that online. Don't keep it in your you know, your LastPass or your password keeper. Don't take a photograph of it, right? Those can be read. Don't put it anywhere digitally ever. Now, the exception is, and unfortunately, this is just the truth, if like you're using a MetaMask and you're logging in, you do have to punch it in when you log in the first time. And then once that computer's connected, that's it. That's that. But that's the only time it's ever entered into a computer that's connected to the internet, right? You don't want digital record of that. Don't keep it in Google Drive or anything like that. Hopefully is that clear? Am I clear on that? All right. Because I'm like, that's important. It's very important. By the way, I did like a onboarding and got a bunch of people set up and then like did a bunch, like an airdrop of a bunch of NFTs to people that were like, here's your first NFT. And then my buddy called me and he's like, dude, I wrote it down like you said, but I put it on like my bedside and my wife cleaned. It's gone. I was like, all right, sorry. The NFT wasn't worth that much. And so I'll help you set up another one. It's all good. But like tell the class, you know what I'm saying, what happened, because that's exactly right. So now we have some basics established, and I want to circle back to the question of why. Why is a move to decentralization needed? Is there actually a problem, or even a potential problem, with a few banks and a few companies controlling the internet and our financial systems? Is that a problem? It's tempting for me to act like that is self-evident and just to skip this entirely, but I think it's a very real question that many people have, especially if they've never dealt with abuses from the powers. So recently, there have been a few international news stories that I think when held together, hopefully neutralize some of the political distinction of each of the stories. That's not why I'm bringing them up, as much as to say like, so don't worry about like how we feel about the politics of these situations, as much as to illustrate something that is happening in both stories that gets at the actual aim, illustrating why we might want decentralized systems, and in this instance, decentralized financial systems. So here are two instances. You can go to the next one. Anyone recognize this? So in Canada, there was a convoy of trucks and truckers from all over the country that descended on Ottawa and began blockading roads in the major city, protesting COVID-19 restrictions, which, by the way, in Canada were like insane, and their mandates. And this was dubbed Freedom Convoy. And protesters occupied the downtown core of the capital of Canada, and they were like, we will not leave until these restrictions and mandates are repealed. So in response to this, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, invoked what's called the Emergencies Act to freeze bank accounts and other centralized financial services used by protesters, as well as others that were trying to support them. Bank accounts, credit cards, their GoFundMe, like whatever it was, like frozen, cut off all access to financial systems. So the Emergencies Act is a statute passed by Parliament of Canada in 1988, which authorized the government of Canada to take extraordinary temporary measures to respond to public welfare emergencies, public order emergencies, international emergencies, and war emergencies. It had never been used. This was the first time that it had been invoked since it was passed in 1988. All right, let's go to the next one. The other story that I think helps illustrate this point is Russia invading Ukraine and the international sanctions that followed. The head of the Russia's central bank announced bad news for the nation. She said, the conditions for the Russian economy have altered dramatically. The new sanctions imposed by foreign states have entailed a considerable increase in the ruble exchange rate and limited the opportunities for Russia to use its gold and foreign currency reserves. Russia's economy is facing the gravest crisis since 1991 fall of the Soviet Union, after the West imposed heavy sanctions on almost every Russian financial and corporate system following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. The Kremlin accused the U.S. of declaring economic war on Russia. So these stories together, I think, illustrate ways that centralized powers can weaponize financial systems. And this reality is probably the most obvious of arguments to be wary of centralized institutions, lest one day it is your accounts that they freeze. So Trudeau, invoking the Emergency Act, made it so that the Canadian government could freeze its citizens' bank accounts without due process or court order. The order said that the banks and financial services provided included credit unions, loan companies, crowdfunding platforms, and crypto exchanges. Wait a minute. I thought that crypto was like an alternative. But remember I said there are these centralized exchanges. And this is what they actually still answer like a bank to the government. Again, public restroom. Like get them out, right? But providing any financial or related services to people associated with the protest. So it's important to remind you of the emphasis in the... So cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum can be held in these non-custodial wallets, which gives sovereignty to the individual that holds possession of that seed phrase, real power. Remember, not your keys, not your crypto. So in Canada, if you were involved in or supporting, like if that was like grandpa or something, you're like supporting, like trying to make sure he can eat, they could freeze your life savings, cancel your credit, stop your mortgage application, eliminate you from the banking system, and blacklist your crypto wallet from interacting or transacting with any centralized exchanges. So even if you hated everything that convoy stood for, it's important that we don't overlook the undermining of rights and due process that took place. This could have been Black Lives Matter. This could have been a religious group. This could have been a political party. In the end, it doesn't matter. What we need to ask is, what if it was you? And when we think about rights and rules, it's really important that we do not lose sight of what should be out of bounds. We don't lose sight of that because we just don't agree with the people that it's happening to. The tables could turn in a moment's notice. This has caused a lot of Canadians, regardless of their feelings about that particular protest, to consider taking their money out of the banks. Go ahead to the next one. Some of you will know DHH. This is a Danish programmer, the creator of Ruby on Rails web development framework. He has been a longtime vocal critic of cryptocurrencies, but then he recently published an incredible article. I really encourage you to look it up and read it. I was wrong. We need crypto. In direct response to these events in Canada, in the article he wrote, I don't think we have any idea what kind of radicalizing seeds have been planted by Trudeau with these actions. This is one of those world events that you can imagine a documentary of the future opening with. It all started when. So whether it's a Ukrainian fleeing war, a Canadian protester, a Russian trying to protect their life savings, the self-custody of non-sovereign money enables people to protect the value of their wealth from the decisions of misaligned political powers. It is extremely useful to the individuals of both Russia and Ukraine that are being devastated by conflict. Ukrainian and Russian citizens both were able to turn to cryptocurrencies to navigate while still under extreme sanction. There was a huge spike, if you watched at that time, during the ruble BTC exchange. The volumes were through the roof, astronomical. And there were reports from the ground like the following tweet. My Ukrainian credit cards don't work anymore. I'm safe physically in Kazakhstan, but all my savings are gone. Crypto is the only money that I have. And today I can say without exaggeration that BTC, ETH, and NFTs are going to save my life while I can't come back home. Crypto disproportionately empowers individuals, not nations, not institutions, not oligarchs. And there are drawbacks to relying on a bank or a crypto exchange for custody of your assets. For example, you must authenticate yourself at the bank or every time that you want so they can let you access your accounts. Now, normally that's a good thing until you try to like run some transaction and they go, oh, that seems like out of normal, and they freeze your card. Does this ever happen to you? Or like, I travel, but I didn't tell them, and they let my card shut down. It's like, what it reveals is that these intermediaries actually control your assets, that they're the ones that give you permission to access them, and they can take that permission away. This is one of the critical differences with cryptocurrency. You can be the custodian of your own digital assets, which is where the term self-custody comes from. And beyond there being just drawbacks to putting your assets in trust into centralized powers, there are many, many, many people, many whom I know, that for a variety of reasons are not permitted to participate in the banking system to begin with. Like, for example, in our community, in the university area, there's all these migrant communities that, for one reason or another, they cannot participate in the banking system. They work for cash, maybe they're not here legally. Like, there's a bunch of different versions or scenarios of this. Working class, poor neighborhood. So they carry a ton of cash, like foolishly, but where can they deposit it? Where can they put it? And now others in the neighborhood are going, oh, those Mexican boys have a ton of cash, and they're getting jumped and they're getting robbed because of this scenario. I could go on and on, but for the sake of time, I want to like move on to some of the basic elements that you should be familiar with, like tokens, NFTs, transactions, gas. So I think the easiest to start with is to understand a standard token. This could be ETH or Bitcoin or DAI or Doge or one of a million other digital currencies. They've proliferated substantially. But tokens are what you would call fungible. It's not a word most of us knew kind of before some of this, but it simply means identical, like swappable. So like if I have an ETH and Leo has an ETH and we like traded it, it's basically pointless. Like it's of the same value. Or if I had a $5 bill and you had a $5 bill, it's like they're swappable, right? And so that's what the term fungible means. And in the Ethereum ecosystem, tokens are a protocol known as ERC-20. And because of the proliferation of tokens and uses for them, the ability to exchange one token type for another is essential to engaging in decentralized finance or DeFi and Web3 really as a whole. So that's what's called swapping tokens. And it's really fundamental to DeFi primitive. And the good news for those learning about all of this for the first time, a tool like MetaMask has like swap built right in on the wallet, which is great, works really well. There are other ways you can do that, decentralized exchanges, things like that. But it's a nice like, ooh, that's, there you go, it's right there. Now, within the world of DeFi, there's all kinds of things that you can do with your currencies, and we won't be able to dig into all of those. And some of the examples that, you know, to highlight a few is like swapping, like I just talked about, liquidity pools. So this is like providing tokens to a pool where others can swap, and it's a way to kind of pull out. There's arbitrage, which is like between marketplaces. This is a great way for ensuring stability and token price across marketplaces. Loans, where you can be both borrower or lender if you needed to borrow. And then staking, so depositing tokens to secure a network and or earn interest. DeFi is made up of a community of protocols, tools that have been created as public goods. So let's say someone comes up with a program. On Ethereum, programs are called smart contracts. You referred to that earlier. These programs are smart contracts. Let's say someone comes up with one that allows you to take out a loan. In DeFi, that would be called a lending protocol. And these protocols work predictably. They work as programmed, no matter who is accessing them, with total transparency into their usage through blockchain records. So once that lending protocol is published, anyone can use it to take out a loan if the proper inputs are provided for. They can even copy that code and make their own version of it. And in this sense, it's considered a public good. It's a resource for all of us to use if we choose to do so. So users generally interact with these DeFi protocols through their website or dApp by connecting their wallet and giving that dApp permission access to their tokens. These programs built on Ethereum are called smart contracts. Go to the next one. So smart contracts are generally built on an ERC 721 protocol, which is also known as an NFT. So wait, NFTs aren't just like a picture of a monkey. They're that too. But no, actually there's it's an entire program kind of written. So a smart contract is a self-executing contract with terms of the agreements between buyer and seller being directly written into the lines of the code. So if you think about the pictures that we're familiar with, think of like the back of it as like an entire contract, a certificate of authenticity and all the record of ownership and residual income to the artist and all that. It's like it's a contract on, let's say, the back of the monkey or whatever. So the code and the agreements contained in it exist across distributed, decentralized networks, the blockchain, and the code controls the execution, and transactions are trackable and they're irreversible. So smart contracts permit trusted transactions and agreements to be carried out among disparate anonymous parties without the need for a central authority, legal system, or enforcement mechanism. Let's go ahead to this next slide. I think the best way to illustrate this is a vending machine. When someone wants a drink or a snack from a vending machine, they don't need to call for help or ask anyone. They simply provide the proper inputs. You put in your couple dollars or your coins, and then you put B2 or wherever the Butterfingers are, and then you get the output that you wanted with your inputs. It's automated. If you give it the proper inputs, you'll get the right outputs. That is effectively a smart contract. It is a simple code that facilitates a transaction. Make sense? All right, so what? Why might this be useful? So let's take, for example, Kickstarter. Kickstarter is a crowdfunding platform. Probably most of you are familiar with it. It's great. I love it. Where projects can raise money from a collection of supporters, and when they achieve their goal, the platform will debit the supporters and credit the project. It's a great platform. It's served many projects extremely well, and it also necessitates this trusted third-party broker, namely, in this case, Kickstarter, to debit and credit appropriately. So this is a great example of a function that can be done by a simple code on a smart contract. Instead of trusting a third party, a smart contract, by the way, has a wallet in it. It can store funds. So let's say people deposited funds that, if all of the funds were met, would be given to the project, but if it wasn't in a certain timeline, would be deployed back to their wallets or something like that. But this is just one of endless examples of what can be done. Smart contracts are actually brilliant. I would say they're brilliant contracts. They give you, here's what they give you, autonomy. So you're the one making the agreement. There's no need for brokers, lawyers, intermediaries, trust. Your documents are encrypted on a shared ledger, and there's no way for someone to say they've been lost. There's backup. On the blockchain, documentation is duplicated many times across the different nodes of the network. Safety. There is no hacking a blockchain. Speed. By the way, where there is hacking, it's social hacking. It's like you gave them that seed phrase because you're dumb, and like that's what happens. And in some cases, not because you're dumb, it's because they're really smart. I've heard some really sick scenarios of that. But to actually change the data on a blockchain, it's an immutable ledger. It is not possible. Speed. You ordinarily have to spend chunks of time doing paperwork to manually process documents. God, I bought a car for our nonprofit recently. I was like, it took 9 hours. It was crazy to me. But anyway, smart contracts use software code to automate tasks and can shave hours off of a range of business processes. Savings. Smart contracts can save you money because they knock out the presence of intermediaries. So like, for instance, you might have had to pay a notary to witness the transaction. In this case, that's not true. And then accuracy. Automated contracts are not only faster and cheaper, but they avoid the errors that come from manually filling out heaps of forms. There are so many use cases for this technology that we've only begun to realize the possibilities. There's no end to the range of industries it can impact from, I don't know, payment on delivery, insurance, title. The list goes on and on. In fact, not 2 years ago, right here in Tampa Bay, and I think some of our ladies in the back might be familiar with this or were involved in this, was the first real estate sale that took place as an NFT. And so while there are millions of other things that I would love to dig into and talk about, I want to like kind of wrap us up, and hopefully we have, before we get run off, a little bit of time for some back and forth. But I want to cover one last thing, because I would consider to miss this a total failure of a 101 course: gas. Transactions cost gas. So you've heard of mining Bitcoin, mining Ethereum. So what is that? And like, how does it work? Well, simply put, running a node to validate and execute transactions onto the blockchain is a way that is what mining looks like, right? And it's a great way to earn, but where does that money come from? That money comes from every single one of us that uses the network. And so we pay transaction fees. So almost every transaction that you make on the network will cost what we call gas. Now, sometimes that's a nominal number that's easy to stomach. And sometimes it's an outrageous number that makes you think this whole thing is broken and it'll never work. So those fees are based on a couple things. Those fees are based on the size of the data size of the transaction. So it's much cheaper to like send you a couple ERC-20 tokens. Like, here's a few ETH. It doesn't even matter like the value of that transaction. It's just, it's an easy thing to do. Thank you for that. whereas if I'm publishing a smart contract with a lot of data in that contract, that can be very expensive. The other thing that it depends on is the vault, the supply and the demand on the network. So if there's a lot of traffic at a certain time, so there's been a time where I've come to do something on the network and I'm like, what the hell? And then I'll just go Google like mints, drops, like what's going on today? And it's like, oh, there's some huge thing going. Like there's just like major traffic times where there's like a bottleneck. It's just simple supply and demand. So an analogy I thought of that I think helps understand this is Uber. Have you ever tried to get Uber outside of a big event when everyone's trying to leave and they want $900 to get you 15 miles or something? It's like, what are we talking about? But that's a surge charge, and it's exact same thing. It's the exact same thing. It's like there's only so many cars, there's only so many transactions that can be mined, and all of you want in. So supply and demand. This is how that goes. But the beautiful thing about the fees on the blockchain is that they're transparent. You can easily check what it will cost to run a transaction. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes you go, well, maybe I better wait for the morning and see what it looks like then. But I think as these networks scale and more nodes are added to the network, as well as some of the technological advancements like layer 2 solutions, things that we're not going to get into tonight, maybe for a deeper, longer class, are going to help making transactions more and more affordable and accessible. We're still very early in so much of this technology. By the way, I want to show you, go ahead, there's one more slide. This just stood out to me. So this is just Western Union to send money to El Salvador. Let's see, how much would I spend? How much does Western Union charge to send $100 overseas from your bank account? Significant fee of $14. Sending the same amount from your credit card could cost you $20.50. The maximum you can send in $5,000 in a day, that'll cost you $243. Blockchains are making a world of a difference for folks that are sending remittances to their country. Just look at what our centralized systems are charging, and you wouldn't believe the hoops they make people jump through and some of the time some of these transactions can take. Blockchains are immediate, and in this case, much cheaper and a phenomenal solution in this particular use case. All right, so I'm going to shut up. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Hopefully this was thought-provoking and somewhat helpful. I don't know how that, maybe we wait till they come shoo us or whatever, but like, let's chat a little bit. I mean, one of my biggest goals for tonight is really like y'all really getting to know each other and joining to the meetup. So you know, we play pickleball next time or something like that. But yeah, any thoughts, any questions?